I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about comics and comic conventions. We're going to talk about what is an increasingly influential part of our cultural landscape and the reasons for comics' enduring popularity. My guests will be Stephen Solomon of Comic-Con, Indianapolis comic book artist Stuart Sager, and Mike Costello of Downtown Comics. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, Twitter is WFYI, Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We've got a fun show today. We're going to be talking about comics and Comic-Con. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Shoot us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests are all connected with the industry from different points. It's going to be fun to talk with them, starting with Stuart Sager, who is an Indianapolis comic book artist. Stuart, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's good to have you here. Mike Costello of Downtown Comics. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John.
And joining us by phone is Stephen Solomon with Comic-Con. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. Well, I want to talk a little bit.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, certainly. It's good to have you here. I want to talk a little bit about the nature of what draws people to comics. We were talking actually before we went on the air, and what struck me is with people, it's sort of a universal thing. Everybody's got their own story about how they connected with this particular art form. And I will admit, when I was young, comics were a huge part of my life. I mean, I would say that they helped me learn to read and really opened the whole world of literature and learning to me. So I feel a huge debt to the art form itself. But Stuart, let's start this conversation by talking about what drew you. You work, you create comics. What drew you to the form?
Many things. When I was very little, it struck me one of the things that was exciting about comic books was that they really seemed that they were made for me as a child. They weren't a junior version of an adult thing. A comic book is a comic book, and they were aimed specifically at me. I always liked the characters. I always liked art. I liked the story. As an adult who creates comic books now, one of the things that has kept me involved with them is that I can create a comic book by myself. If I like the story, if I like the art, I can do both jobs all in one. Relative to making a movie or something like that, if I have a vision.
Which is a massively vision, collaborative effort.
Yeah. Right. If I have a vision, I can do it entirely by myself. When the thing comes out, it is exactly the way I intended it to be.
Mike, how about you? What started you?
Probably early on, mostly it was just the amount of material. I was a voracious reader as a kid, like you were saying, and getting books, you tend to run out of stuff very quickly, of stuff you want to read. But then you find comics, and there was just so much of it. It was just like walking, being hungry and walking into a McDonald's. You're like, oh my God, there's comics everywhere. So I just picked a couple up and just kept on going. I just couldn't get enough of them. I just bought everything that I could find, read everything that my friends had. It didn't matter at the time when I started.
Stephen, how about you? Where did you start?
Well, as a little kid, I was a kid in the early 90s, so the X-Men were the hot thing then, and the cartoon was out. So as soon as I got involved and saw the X-Men on TV, then I knew I had to read the comics as well. So that's how I got in.
And how about the whole notion of Comic-Con, which has exploded? Obviously, it's coming here to Indy as well. What prompted that?
Well, you know, a lot of different things. I just, in my personal opinion, I'm sure there are lots of opinions out there, but I feel like going back to X-Men, actually, you know, when the first X-Men movie came out in 2000, I think that really spurred on the general public to take notice. And, you know, from that, more and more films came out, which, you know, are marketed to such a huge audience, and more people became interested. And that's just, you know, sort of snowballed over the last almost 15 years now.
Mike, you know, Steven has alluded to the films, and that has changed the business.
Oh, yes, very much so.
How so? In what ways?
Well, I think like he was saying, it's expanded the audience to the notion that comics are out there and that they can be used to create this wider entertainment. There was so many people that were just still shocked that comic books were still being made. As of 10 years ago, they would walk into a store and be shocked there was a store that sold something that they thought that didn't exist anymore. So the movies really opened up just the amount of people that were exposed to the idea of comic books.
Why were people shocked that they weren't being made anymore?
For the most part, it's because they read them as kids, probably, but they felt like comic books were for children. That the notion that an adult, that someone over the age of, say, 12 or 14 would read a comic book was just so foreign because they were targeted at kids, and that hasn't been the case for so long, you know. So they just never occurred to them that people would grow up and still use it, you know, as an entertainment medium or as a hobby or whatever. And so it just shocked them. I mean,
Stuart, yeah, please.
Yeah, I want to add to that. I think for me, I've always kind of felt that the one of the real game changers really was the 1989 Batman movie. That's the one I think kind of opened the door on for a few reasons. One is
it was huge.
Can never overestimate the impact that money makes on something. And I remember reading that the Batman movie generated more money than Marvel Comics had in its entire existence up to that point. That's big. Mm-hmm. When you have a movie like that, and then you also can bring a star to it like Jack Nicholson, you can bring an adult audience.
Did it overshadow? I mean, and Stuart, I'm going to stay with you on this one, but give everybody a crack at it. I know there has been some discussion about, you know, the movies now. The film industry now is focusing on trying to find, you know, one superhero or comic derived franchise after another. It's like, this is up until now an untilled field, and they're finding that people do care about these characters and they care about these stories. What has that done to the medium itself, though, the original medium, the comic books? I mean, have the films been a blessing, presumably because they open up a greater audience, but does
Certainly.
It affect the way that the stories are told in the comic books? I'll start with you, Stuart, since you do
Well, you've got two different mediums that can operate independently of one another, but at the same time, they're dealing with the same characters and, in many cases, the exact same fan base. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be looking over their shoulder to see what the other is doing. A movie very often will, at least what seems to have been the case, will draw its source material from the comic books. The comic books have to be very aware of how the movies are received. One is reflecting the other in terms of how the audience responds to what they're offered. You can have an Avengers movie come out, and if you have, you know, I don't remember the actor's name, but the actor who plays Thor seems to be immensely popular right now. People love that guy. That is definitely affecting how many comic books Thor appears in each month. You have to be feeling that on your end, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, actually, you know, it started with the X-Men movie, that the movie studio's success was noticed by the people that published the comics. And before, they'd been two separate entities for the most part. But after the X-Men movie came out, you saw in the comic books that they changed costumes to more of the movie costumes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then as we move down the years now, you do have this synergy growing closer and closer to what's in the movies is reflected in the comics. We have a Spider-Man movie coming out in 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Parker, who is Spider-Man, has been dead now these last couple of years.
Within the comic book.
Yeah, within the comic book. Now, he will be back alive in April, conveniently enough, so that when the movie comes out in May, if someone wants to come in and buy a Spider-Man comic book, I don't have to tell them, well, it's not Peter Parker Spider-Man, it's this other somebody. So they definitely work together now. You will see lineup changes, like he said. Thor actually didn't exactly increase Thor, but it did increase Loki.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was a huge, huge right. popular villain in the movies, but he had not been in the comics for years, and now he's got his own title.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's the power of these movies.
I want to say the other thing too is I talk to people all the time when I tell them what I do for a living, and they sort of light up and they say, "Oh, I love comic books," mm-hmm. and we all love to hear that. I often think though that when they say they love comic books, what they may actually mean is they love superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been talking a little bit about comics and movies, but equally mm-hmm. just as large as those two industries are, we have video games.
Mm-hmm.
And all three of these things are looking at each other, as well as toys. So I meet people all the time who will say they're, whatever, a Batman fan. Well, mm-hmm. okay, so tell me why you like Batman. And they'll tell me the comic they read that month, the movie they last saw, what they played in the video game, and they're likely wearing a Batman T-shirt. And this isn't just a medium. And that's where this convention comes from.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's more of a lifestyle thing now.
We are talking about comics and Indie Comic Con here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI, and Twitter is WFYI. Well, I want to stick with the movies for just a little bit before we exhaust, and then I want to drill down into how the comics have changed over time. But, you know, does it correspond? We've talked about how the Batman movie, you know, 25 years ago was a huge game changer for the industry. Then does it also follow that, you know, I guess the Green Lantern movie, which I never saw, was a huge bomb? Did it have, a depressing effect then on that title and that character's arc, or,
Some movies don't move the needle as much as you would think they do.
And actually,
some movies you've never heard of move the needle a lot. If you've heard of Scott Pilgrim, mm-hmm. did you hear of that movie? Or mm-hmm. 300,
mm-hmm.
Sin City. These movies moved an extreme amount of a very limited supply of material for those projects. Those were all comic book projects mm-hmm. that were turned into movies. So something like a Green Lantern that's been around a while, that is already big in comic books. Actually, Green Lantern, at the time the movie came out, was extremely popular in the comics. He was probably a top 10 comic book being made already. So the movie didn't depress it or extend it. It just didn't have an effect. Mm-hmm. Most people like you either didn't see it or were unhappy with it. So, but it didn't really have I don't think we've ever had a situation where a movie actually made something worse in comic books. I can't remember an example Yeah, I mean, something was either bad and got better, or, you know, was bad and stayed bad, you know, or was better and just stayed the same. So,
and Stephen, what can people expect at Comic-Con?
Well, in general, you know, it appeals to a wide demographic of people, mostly families. You know, we bring in a lot of younger parents that have young kids, which is why we allow kids to attend for free. We bring in artists. Unfortunately, Stuart couldn't attend, but we have a lot of great artists.
Not for lack of desire. I was already booked. I apologize for that.
No, that's all right. But we have a lot of great artists. Hopefully, Stuart will be able to be there next year. So in terms of what, you know, the comics bring, you know, they can get sketches. They can buy comics from the artists. They can just get autographs and things like that. But also, you know, to appeal to the more, I guess, general audience that might not necessarily be comic readers. We have a few celebrity guests there, like Maisie Williams from the Game of Thrones, and we have Evan Peters, who's on American Horror Story, and he's going to be in the new X-Men movie. So, you know, there's a lot of things that there's something for everyone, I think, is the overall gist. Anyone that can get into superheroes or anything that could even be classified as, dare I say, nerdy, I think would enjoy it.
And let me, if people do want to attend, how do they go about doing that? Where do they get information?
It's Indiana Comic IndianaComicCon.com.
Okay, give that to him again.
Just IndianaComicCon.com. And there's a tickets button on the left side of the website, and just click on that, and that has all the information. Tickets are available in advance and also at the door during the convention itself.
We are talking about comics and Indie Comic Con here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI, and Twitter is WFYI. My guests are Stuart Sager, an Indianapolis comic book artist, Mike Costello of Downtown Comics, and Stephen Solomon with Comic-Con. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about comics and Indie Comic Con here on No Limits. My guests are Stuart Sager, an Indianapolis comic book artist, Mike Costello of Downtown Comics, and Stephen Solomon of Comic Con. Carl, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Carl, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi, Carl. What's on your mind?
Oh, I was just curious how this weekend's event is different than the convention I keep hearing about that's coming up in May called TopCon.
TopCon?
PopCon.
PopCon. PopCon. Okay, Stuart, you jumped in on that, or was it Mike? Stuart, what's the difference?
I can talk about it a little bit. Okay.
Okay.
So, well, the first thing is, in some instances we don't know, is we don't have either one of them yet. These are both first-year shows. Indianapolis has gone a long time without a comic book convention. I think this is the first year we're going to have a three-day comic book convention. It just so happens we are having two of them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the Indiana Comic-Con, and then later in May there's going to be the Indy Pop-Con.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, the first convention, the Indiana Comic-Con, is going to focus more specifically on comic books.
Yeah, that would be my take on it.
And then the Indie Pop Con, I think the pop is actually making reference to popular culture. It will certainly have an anchor in comic books, but I think it's going to try to expand more to include things like cosplay, gaming, and probably video games, something like that. Now, here's where I give a plug. I know that I am going to be at the Indie Pop Con.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they've asked me to do the program cover for it. And this is where I feel bad, because I've waited so long living in Indianapolis for a comic book convention like this to come along. When I heard about the Indiana Comic Con, the one that is this weekend, I was fantastically excited. I thought I had to be there. I had already agreed to do a show in Lexington the same weekend. And that's the only reason why I'm not doing both of them, because I really wish I could.
And Stephen, I know we lost you for a second, but you're back.
Yeah.
Question, Carl's on the line, and he's got a question about the difference between Comic Con and Pop Con.
Well, that's a good question. I think PopCon, as I heard Stuart allude to, is it's a little bit more general in terms of the popular culture that it caters to. While we do have some generalized pop culture guests, we are still more of a targeted comic convention, I suppose. You know, we have a fairly large lineup of comic guests. So I think that's what sets us apart the most. But, you know, there is a lot of similarities. I think there's going to be a lot of cosplayers at both. The comic guests, I think, in general, and perhaps the comic vendors, would probably have a little bit more in terms of the vintage comics and things like that available. But I think that's probably the biggest element.
And that alludes to a different, a change in sort of the business. I mean, when I started reading comic books long, long, long ago, the notion of kind of collecting them was the antithesis of the experience, that, you know, my buddies and I would get them and we'd trade them back and forth, and, you know, within a couple of days they were dog-eared. We never thought of putting them in cellophane or anything like that.
That's why they're valuable now.
Yeah, they are, because we went through all of that, Mike. But I guess where I'm going, he makes reference to the vintage comics and all of that. How does the business break down? I mean, what in your shop, how much of your revenue stream is, say, selling new comic books as opposed to selling, you know, vintage or older collectible comic books?
Oh, it certainly is new. Mm-hmm. New comic books is certainly where the business is. The vintage market is certainly there, but it's a much tougher market, especially in a town with a less population base. Mm-hmm. You tend to see stores do better in higher population markets with the vintage stuff. It's just a bigger base to draw from in terms of how much money they have, how you get your comics, you know, to actually sell. You have to go out and find them, things like that. So for us, yeah, it's new comics.
Now, we've gotten an email question from a listener named Allie, who asked, she's the mother of a couple of African-American children and was looking for comic book options, presumably superhero options, for her to share with her children. What do you recommend? I mean, what are there? Because there is, and I want to take that in a direction of really how the, you know, at least in the earliest days of the comic books, in the, you know, the 30s, 40s, and 50s, it was one collection of white guys after another, and it began to open up to some degree after that. I'd like to talk about that process, but what recommendations would you have for her?
It depends on exactly how old her kids are, but I would say right now my number one idea for that particular segment would be a title called Ultimate Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. The lead character is named Miles Morales.
She referenced that
13 to 14 years old. Yeah, and he's African American, so that's probably the number one. Now it can skew a tad older into that age range. So if they're 5 or 6 years old, I mean, they can certainly still look at the pictures and everything like that. But yeah, that'd be my number one idea. After that, well, I mean, diversity is an issue. I can't, off the top of my head, I mean, the books that are based on the cartoons always tend to have diversity within them. So Teen Titans Go, which is currently on the Cartoon Network, has a character named Cyborg as one of the team with Robin and Starfire and everything like that. You have the Avengers and Captain America. The Falcon is on that team. The Black Panther's on that team. Characters like that. So Storm has had, she's the goddess, mm-hmm, from the X-Men. She's had her own comic at various times. You know, it goes in and out of favor, but she'll be in the X-Men movie that's coming out this year. So
how has that evolved over time? I mean, I am going to date myself here, but I remember that the first days when the comic book industry and the art form was trying to deal with the whole issue of race. And, you know, one of the first characters was a character named Luke Cage in Marvel, who, you know, if you read those things now, they read like an unintentional parody, like, you know, Hollywood Shuffle, you know, in comic book form. So it wasn't particularly effective. How not just on issues of race, but the other social parameters, how the comics dealt with that. I'll start with Mike and then let Steven have a crack at that as well.
Well, they're definitely trying. And the issue you get into is the comic book companies want the diversity, and occasionally you'll get some blowback from people who are maybe longer time readers that the companies are doing diversity for diversity's sake and not in terms of actual character. So when Nick Fury in the Avengers was played by Samuel L. Jackson, there was a mild blowback from that because the original Nick Fury as created, mm-hmm, was the guy with the eye patch, and obviously he was white. Now, when Marvel created this,
and a World War II veteran,
and a World War II veteran, yeah, exactly. Well, he took a formula to not age, so okay. We get around that very easy in comics. But then, you know, Marvel had created a separate line of comics, this Ultimate line that I referred to with, mm-hmm, Ultimate Spider-Man, and in that universe, they made Nick Fury black. So there was a mild you know, there was a mild uproar at that time when the comic book was created. And then obviously they use that template when they put him on the movie screen. So, you know, I think the comic book companies are trying. And like you said, in the 70s, it seemed more like caricatures of. So, you know, Luke Cage, especially an example, mm-hmm. seems like a 70s blaxploitation movie, kind of like, you know, Shaft or
a parody.
If you remember that James Bond
movie,
Live and Let Die. Yeah, I mean, you know, So yeah, I think they're doing a better job. I mean, Luke Cage, as he's portrayed now, is just—he's a superhero. I mean, he happens to be black, but he's a superhero, and everything—he's pretty much seems like a normal guy. You know, I mean, there's not that obvious caricature concept to him now. So,
Stephen, how large a concern is diversity?
I think it's actually pretty large, and I think that overall the industry has done a very good job of addressing not just, you know, issues of race, but, you know, homosexuality, other maybe controversial topics like drug use and things, religion, you know, since at least the late 70s. But, you know, it's been getting more and more, I suppose, less satirical over the years. Like you mentioned before, in the early days, it may have seemed a little bit hokey, but I think they're getting better at hunting the issues, but I think they have done a good job overall since the late 70s.
Stuart?
I think one of the things to remind ourselves here is that the comic books are a medium, mm-hmm. and there are many, many publishers of comics. As I said earlier, I think a lot of times people think of comic books. They say comic books, but they think superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
Superman and Batman have been with us for a long time. Mm-hmm. They are the ones we think of first. But if someone does a little bit of digging and looks around to see what is coming out from someone other than just the largest of the largest companies, there's a lot mm-hmm. of diversity. I would really encourage people to look at comic books as not just superheroes, but all kinds of different genres. An event that I love to go to each year is there's a smaller comic book convention in Columbus, Ohio called SPACE, mm-hmm. which stands for Small Press Alternative Comics Expo. And there just about aren't any superheroes there. Mm-hmm. And these are all comic books made by individuals that really aren't a part of a larger company. And if you want to look at diversity, the place is dripping with it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't talk about that a whole lot because that doesn't get turned into a movie.
So is it a little bit like the whole book publishing and the independent book publishing?
Well, why would it not be?
It's a publication. Yeah.
It's dangerous if we were talking about comic books, or if let's substitute in the place of comic books, music. If I said, hey, do you like music? If you just turn on the radio, mm-hmm. you listen to the local stations here, you'd think all music, A, has to have singing, B, has to be really modern, probably is pop. You know, and you'd be ruling out all classical, all different countries, all different languages, all different instruments. That's the problem with talking about comic books in terms of just superheroes.
But obviously, like the model for book publishing is the business model for the artist is brutal. I mean, in that there are 600,000 published authors in the United States and Canada, and only 3,000 of them don't have day jobs, which tells you, you know, there's not a lot of money for the creator. For those independent and, you know, to use the book term, small press uh-huh. creators of comic books, is it possible to make a living, Stuart?
I would say, well, it has been for me, certainly, and I think it has been for other people. We're in an interesting age right now where you have things like Kickstarter that are showing everyone that there are interest in projects we never imagined what kind of interest there was going to be in. We do have a situation with most comic book stores right now where they get most all their product from Diamond, mm-hmm. which is the major comic distributor in North America. I self-published a comic book years ago, and Diamond approached me and asked to carry it. They distributed my comic book not only all over North America, but in other parts of the world as well. And I was just one guy here in Indianapolis making a comic book by myself.
Mm-hmm. What was it? Out of curiosity, what's the cost for publishing a comic book by yourself? How much did that?
Well, it depends on how far into the deep end of the pool you wish to jump. You know, I would say anybody who wants to publish something, you can definitely get going for just a couple thousand dollars. Now, that sounds like a lot of money on one hand. On the other hand, if you said, we're going to go into a business venture by myself and I can get started for a couple thousand dollars, cheap.
We are talking about comics and Comic-Con here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Gabe, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. Just wanted to say, first, thank you. but thank you for talking about diversity in comics as well, and for bringing on the guys who are putting the putting together the convention this weekend.
Glad to do it. You have a question or?
Particular interest to me because I'm biased because I have some panels at the con this weekend, so I hope a lot of people are coming.
Awesome.
But also on the topic of diversity, I wanted to ask about webcomics and kind of talking about independent publishing. I actually just had lunch with somebody who's going to be on another panel I'm doing at C2E2 about diversity in comics, and he has a comic with LGBTQ characters called The Boy in Pink Earmuffs, and it's kind of about bullying and kind of issues that little kids might face. So it's kind of getting just like a really niche or a specific thing that he can do maybe as a web comic that maybe you wouldn't see at a mainstream comic. And I'm just wondering what you guys think of independent or of web comics as part of the comics atmosphere at present.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Gabe. We'll try to get you an answer. Stephen, I'll start with you on that one. What role do web comics and, you know, are they being, is the delivery system, to use something we do in media, a part of the discussion now too?
Well, in my personal opinion, I think that web comics are great because it allows anybody, you know, with any creative drive to get the ideas out, get the images out that they want to do, even if they're, you know, not hooked up with a giant publishing and printing company. I sort of think that right now is a renaissance as far as comics go, just going back to the diversity of comics in general,
mm-hmm.
Because anybody who's interested can really get into it for a low cost. That's why, you know, there's like Stuart said, there's a lot of great publishers out there that aren't necessarily Marvel or DC that still create great products. Image is probably the biggest of the small publishers, I suppose. And they've had great titles out there for the last few years, and there's lots of other, you know, smaller print publishers, even smaller than that, that are putting out great materials, and webcomics are just another avenue for that to happen.
And I got to ask, Mike, web comics and the whole digital thing, are they threatening to do to your business what ebooks did to Borders and bookstores? Is it creating pressure on your model? Or?
Certainly the biggest point of discussion between us as retailers and the comic book companies themselves has been digital. What's its effect? What effects it going to have? And we're still ongoing, but I would say that the roof or sky was falling 4 years ago, and now it's just a sky. So no, at the present time, we don't see the negative effect of the digital world. Now, can that change? Sure.
Are you anticipating that it will change? I mean, are you guys starting to make plans?
We always have plans, but I would say, in my personal opinion, is that digital has the opportunity to reach such a wide and diverse amount of people that have never been exposed to comic mm-hmm. books. And I think the comic book's true state is the printed form. Like, mm-hmm. a book does not change between being a book and being on a screen.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just printed words. Whereas I believe a comic book's true form is in print, is in the physical. So even though the digital is convenient and it may even be cost effective, ultimately I think people gravitate towards the physical.
We are talking about comics and Comic-Con here on No Limits. We've gotten it looks like a tweet from a listener who wanted to chide me about the Green Lantern movie. Said, while it's not a blockbuster, it was not a bomb, opened to $53 million and made $219 million. That's a fair point. Thank you for correcting the record on that one. We're talking about comics here. My guests are Stuart Sager, Mike Costello, and Stephen Solomon. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about comics and Indie Comic Con here on No Limits. My guests are Stuart Sager, who is an Indianapolis comic book artist, Mike Costello of Downtown Comics, and Stephen Solomon with Comic Con itself. Carl, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, my question is for the panel. I'm curious what their thoughts are on the DC Comics relaunch called The New 52 and what that has had on their brand of characters. And if Marvel Comics is planning on any sort of, you know, relaunch themselves, making their brand a little more fresh, and if that's had any, like, competitive effect in the sales of their comics.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Mike, that's a business question. I think we'll throw it your way.
DC's New 52 was probably the biggest thing that has happened in comic books as a game changer since I've been in business. Mm-hmm. Certainly there have been, like, events like the death of Superman or something like that. But in terms of the business model, that certainly changed the game. They took a chance, they threw a Hail Mary, and it worked for them.
Why did they do that?
Because they saw that no matter what they did, no matter how many tweaks they made to various characters, they couldn't make any traction in the market. People had decided that if they didn't like Superman now, they never would like Superman. Or if they didn't like Green Lantern now, they never would like Green Lantern. So they decided that instead of saying, well, we're going to change Superman, we're going to kill him again or something, they said, we're going to just restart our whole line. We're just starting from scratch. Anyone that wants to jump on in the pool, come on in. It's good for everyone. And it worked. I mean,
is there some part of that? I mean, that, I realize that it strikes me that 30 years ago, there also was sort of an attempt to, you know, relaunch Superman. And
exactly.
After so many years with characters that have such long histories, is this just something the industry has to go through? Stephen, I'm going to ask you about this too, but where they have to do something that kind of scrapes the barnacles off and lets the ship move forward?
Yeah, this is the cycle of comic books now, and the cycle is kind of getting smaller. You're right. There was a big event in the mid-80s that DC tried. Now, they didn't jump all the way in the pool. They kind of hedged their bets, which is why it's not considered as big of a jump. But you see, he was talking about Marvel. Marvel has actually been soft, I guess you could call it, revamping or rebooting their characters over the last couple of years. They haven't done it like DC and say, hey, we're doing this. But Marvel has been doing it. And I think that all comes from not only their movies, but their media exposure in general. They want to make their characters as open to a wider audience as possible. And you do that by always trying to make a way in for people. You know, I mean, I guess the theory is it's daunting to look at the 800th issue of Superman and say, oh, I know what's going on, because you think the other 799 are really important, when they're really not, but psychologically. But if it's on issue 10 or issue 12, oh, okay, well, I can handle that. So,
Stephen, I remember, you know, in other relaunches of characters, there was always some backlash, some pushback saying, do they risk losing audiences if a relaunch is not particularly successful?
You know, it's a tough thing being a comic publisher and comic writer. There's definitely backlashes, but does it lose readers? Yeah, maybe. I think that there are other reasons that probably lose or gain more readers, whether it's, you know, the prices of the comics or what's just happens to be the hot character in the general public. Definitely are backlashes, but, you know, it's just something that comes with introducing new ideas, and not everybody is going to like that particular idea, I suppose.
Want to catch up on a couple of tweets we've gotten and some messages from Facebook. If you'd like to connect with us via Twitter, you can do so at WFYI on Facebook. It's No Limits WFYI. But we got a tweet from Gabriel who said that he would recommend Miranda Mercury. And then Pete also sent us a tweet saying that Luke Cage, whom we've talked about, will be having his own TV show via Netflix in 2015.
That's right.
Robert from Facebook has said comic books cover the full range of fiction and some history, too. I've been out of touch. Are the historic graphic novels getting more respect these days? I'll toss that out to anyone who wants it.
I think all of it is to some extent. I mean, I think this is sort of a renaissance for comic books. Certainly the movies have brought attention to comics. But I think for people to care about something and appreciate it, the first thing you have to do is have them take a look at it. And these movies have brought attention to comics and to graphic novels. We've got probably you're at the comic shop, and you, Steve, you have a convention, a couple of them, I believe. Tell me, aren't we seeing a wider range of people consuming the product than we've probably ever had?
Oh, definitely.
I mean, I think that speaks to...
Yeah, I mean, for things like historical comics and stuff, we get librarians, teachers in looking at that stuff as teaching tools, you know. So maybe the dry textbook story of the American Revolution isn't really hitting all their students, but you give them a colorful graphic novel of the Battle of Yorktown or something like that, and that may be something that they would be more apt to read. Or
is it more successful, though, than... Again, I'm dating myself, but the whole Classics Illustrated and... In the old days, which were sort of the eat your vegetables section of the comic books, that those are the ones that your parents would approve of, but you didn't necessarily want to read yourself.
No, I don't think that from an actual sales perspective that those generate that much money. But I think the quality of when they do it, and there's been various times where certain companies have tried to do that line, that the quality is certainly there. Like Classics Illustrated, and back in the day, maybe came off as a little, lacking
pedantic.
A little. Yeah. But now when they do it, I mean, they have good artists on it. Mm-hmm. They have really good writers. They sometimes take more than one book to do it right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's hard to adapt War and Peace in 23 pages.
Pitches,
so,
yeah,
it's going to take a little bit longer. So no, when they do it, and they do it with a lot of modern mm-hmm. novelists as well. So Stephen King's novels have been adapted. The Game of Thrones are being adapted. You know, stuff like that.
There really isn't a genre that's off limits for comic
right.
books.
No,
and that's I think that's a big key here.
Yeah. We've gotten also from Facebook, a listener named Richard wants to know, we've talked about the films, but this is a different slide. Can the panel discuss the effect of the Big Bang Theory on the popularity of comic books, since that's sort of a theme to that show? Thanks.
Well, it's kind of replaced a comic book guy as my stereotype, I guess, in my field. So it used to be I was the fat guy behind the counter, and now I'm the guy without a life who doesn't make any money behind the counter. So I'm not sure. No, we get a lot of that in the store. It's all good natured. I love Big Bang Theory, and I like the fact that they live in that world and they enjoy it, you know. So anytime anyone mentions it, it's good. And I think, yes, it opens up that realm, especially of going into a comic book store like I was talking about earlier, where that is kind of alien to most people that they even exist. And maybe that's a daunting thing. But now I think that opens it up like, oh, okay, I can go in here. It's not so bad, you know.
We are talking about comics and Comic-Con here on No Limits. Corey, welcome to the program.
Hello, sir, and the panel. Two short questions. One, comic book characters are generally generated out of some traumatic experience. You know, Batman's parents died. Even Godzilla was brought out of from atomic research and the fear of atomic, you know, people being killed by atomic blast. Do you think that, I realize they have to stick with what they have, but could something that's occurring today, do you think there would be good fodder in the world that we live in now for a comic book character to be brought out of that? And my second question, sometimes I see present day, like I saw Barack Obama with an issue of Spider-Man. Do people like that ever get paid for their appearances in those books? And those are my two questions.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Corey Stewart.
A few things. I don't think Obama was paid for his appearance. He's a celebrity, and he's probably doing pretty well. I think Obama's making more money than I do. So I, as a creator, I would like to keep that money to myself. But I think the big thing here is that whether it's the origin of these characters or even the subjects they tackle, I think every generation has their comic books, and comics sort of change that generation. So if you ask the question, should we see a character that is born out of the events of our day, I would say absolutely. You know, these are topical stories. and the stories they tell, they should relate to us. They should be about our lives. I would be surprised if I think about Superman sometimes as being thought of as being a little bit stuffy, but that's only because he has so much history, I believe. Mm-hmm. I think the younger you have a character, the more topical the thing is going to feel.
We've also gotten an email question from a listener named Larry who says, "Dear No Limits, I'm a longtime comic reader, and I'm disappointed about the dominance that comic books are having during this conversation. Original graphic novels are a great way to read a story. I'm also wanting to let the African-American mother know about two books, and I'm going to, it looks like Incognigro and Sentences, The Life of M.F. Grimm." I think to some degree he's speaking to your point, Stuart, with the fact that we focused on comic books, and really he's saying superheroes, when it is a much broader medium than we have been discussing.
You know, it is. I want to try to have people sort of really think open-mindedly about what comic books are and what they can be. And I'll tell you this, if you go to any grade school class in the country and you'll find kids who are making comic books, you're not going to find children who are making movies, mm-hmm. making television shows. It's a little bit harder to do. But comic books, what's great, you can tell a story, words and pictures together. It's very simple. It's very accessible. And the fact that it is that easy to do lends itself to people saying, I have a story I want to tell. Of any subject, and that's where we've seen this explosion of graphic novels in the last probably 20 years or so.
We've gotten also a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, asked, where does the creative process start for you? Does it start with the images? Does it start with a storyline? Does it start with a character?
That's its own show. I'm okay. Happy to talk about that, but I think I would say the best place to start is somebody probably thinks of an idea and they say, I have something I want to say. They have an idea that they see something in society or culture, or perhaps they're even just they're a regular comic book artist or writer working on a character, and they say, well, what if Superman couldn't fly? How would that change the character? How would that unravel to the rest of his world? And I usually think there's a germ of an idea, and somebody goes running with it.
How does it start for you, though, specifically? I mean, if you take me through the creative process for one of your pieces.
Well, for me, I would say it's usually it's born out of a dissatisfaction of wanting to see something, and they're acknowledging there's some sort of a vacuum, you know. And the comic book that I wrote and drew and published to break into the industry with was called Shiver in the Dark, mm-hmm. and I was kind of torn. I wanted to do a horror comic book. I kind of wanted to do a romance comic book. But the one thing that sort of gave me the idea was I had seen many horror movies, novels, so on and so forth, where you see forces of evil and sweet, innocent victim. And I thought, why do we always have to have this sort of helpless, innocent victim? Mm-hmm. What if we had someone that was really much more capable? And maybe, perhaps, they weren't quite as innocent. If they get into trouble, perhaps they deserve it. And how do they navigate that world?
A bad guy could get mugged, too.
Yeah, and so what happens is if you have an idea like that and you think, ooh, that's fascinating, you go to the comic book store and you look around to see what has come out that sort of answers those questions, and you don't find anything. And then you look at movies and you don't find anything. At some point you say, I don't think anyone's done this, and you kick around the idea in your head, what would happen? And if it grabs you, as it grabs me, then you say, okay, I've got to draw this thing.
We are talking about comics and Comic-Con here on No Limits. Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Hello. Great to speak to that's a well-spoken panel. I've enjoyed listening to you guys. My question here doesn't quite follow the flow of the last few minutes, but went to an auction several years ago. I'm sure you guys have heard this type of story. Ended up with a couple boxes, got them home, and I had a lot of, I guess the correct term would be called pulp magazines.
All right.
Some illustrated. And these are from the 20s, 30s. Along with that, there were mixed in some comics, Disney, Gene Autry and stuff from maybe the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Is there much appreciation? I mean, for me, the storylines themselves are a little, a little bit simple. But as far as looking at it from a, you've got a snippet of history holding it in your hand there. And it's pretty fascinating from that aspect. Is there much appreciation for that today as far as people that like to hold that in their hands if I decided to offload these?
Well, they they are part of our history.
Thanks very much, Jeremy.
These are, whether it's Gene Autry or those pulp magazines, I mean, circulation was colossal. And at the very least, these are the stories that led to the stories after them. Almost anyone who wrote a comic book in the 1950s, they read those pulp magazines in the 20s and 30s. And to be honest, I actually still like them. There are lots of people who collect these. And I'm sure Downtown Comics, you carry a lot of this material, don't you?
You don't actually... We don't see it all too often. I mean, the pulps and stuff, that's pretty old. I mean, once you get having those still around after 70, 80, 90 years, I mean, that's a long time.
Well, and it really wasn't a medium when they were published first with the idea that they were sort of considered disposable.
Yeah, and especially anything pre-World War II, most paper products were recycled for World War II. So that's why it's harder to find comics pre-World War II, because most of them were donated for the war effort and stuff like that. So, So I don't know a lot about pulps. I mean, they're old, they're awesome looking, but in terms of it's a niche, you know, audience. You have to find someone wants them. You just have to find them. And then condition's always important too. So that's what I tell everyone.
Now, is there a chance that we've gotten another question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, who asked really kind of a multimedia question? Have there been attempts to marry the comic book or graphic novel form with narration or with voices acting out the characters, especially in this digital era? Stuart, I'll start with you.
I think at some point that's going to start to resemble animation, to be honest. Mm. But we do have things like that. The internet is flash animation looks an awful lot like that. The funny thing is that you've got all these – comic books, as we've sort of discussed before, they don't operate in this vacuum so much anymore. You've got a lot of technology that's being used on comics and even movies, and they start to look a little bit alike at some point.
I mean, the current wave of technology involves kind of the what they call AR, augmented reality, where Marvel is currently doing this with some of their books. There'll be certain areas where you can put an iPad or some sort of device on the comic, and then something happens on the comic. Either you get motion or something, but it's not in the comic itself. You have to have a device to do it. And then, of course, on devices, they do have motion comics with voice. So instead of just reading the comic on your iPad, it'll move a little bit more. There'll be voice acting and stuff like that. But again, comic books as they're currently constituted still is one of those things where they just don't want to do that.
So. I am afraid that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank all three of my guests for a fascinating conversation. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Please join us again on Thursday when we'll be talking about public policy issues. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.